Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out. I'm Billy Allen.
I'm Nils Nielsen.
And I'm John Mayer. For today's show, we are pumped up. Got a great guest. His name is Joe Trinzi. He is the technical coordinator for the national team. He's also a fellow podcast host. His podcast is called The Volleycast, and he's the man. So we're happy to have him. Thanks for coming, Joe.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to finally chat with you guys. You know, I might have my own podcast, but my dad listens to your guys way more. So I had to just get on your guys' show so my dad will actually listen to me now.
Has your dad gone online and given us a review and entered the book contest?
If he hasn't, I'm sure he's probably doing it right now as we speak.
Well, thanks, Mr. Trinzi. Joe, so we know you as data statistics guy. Can you talk about how you first started using statistical analysis with your team?
Yeah, you know, just kind of started it when I was coaching. You know, we already talked about my dad, and you know, my parents were coaches too. And probably like a lot of people, I got into coaching because of my parents. So just was doing that, you know, coaching club and high school level and just trying to get these kids better. And at that level, you don't have this army of assistants or video analysis and all this thing. So I wanted to still be able to coach and not just be a stat keeper during the whole thing. So yeah, just some little basic things where I could record some information and actually be able to take action from it. And that's one big thing. If you're going to use any kind of statistics or data, you have to be able to take action from it. Your goal is not to be a journalist. Your goal is to be a more effective coach. So, I mean, I just started something as basic as let's look at how many times when the opponent serves in, we get a successful swing back the other way. And that was something that we could look at when we were in practice, and we could do practice goals where, all right, in this rotation, we got to get 4 out of 5 good swings to rotate or different things like that. And then from just there, if we want to get into the nuts and bolts of the volleyball aspect of it, as we were going, the system that I really liked with that is just really flexible was just something as simple as recording in-system efficiency, you know, kills, blocks, errors, and attempts, and out-of-system efficiency, kills, blocks, errors, and attempts. And then you just record if you have some reception errors. If you just record those things, which you can totally record them at the end of the rally, you don't even need to have anything during the rally. You just pick a favorite and make a mark. From those three things, you can know what your in-system efficiency is, what your out-of-system efficiency is. And then you also know a basic concept of your passing efficiency because you just record all your in-system attempts and all your out-of-system attempts. And maybe you're 50% in-system or 60 or whatever it is. And then from there, you just have those three things, and usually you're weaker in one of those three aspects, and that's what you need to train more practice. So I always wanted to have a system that was set up so it would help me know what to do in practice, because ultimately you can have all the information you want, but if it doesn't make your practice any better, you're just kind of wasting your time.
Yeah, it's awesome. And it's obvious to think, hey, you work with the national team. Of course, you guys are tracking stuff and like analyzing everything, but even at that lower level, it's so important to be taking stats and knowing what your team's doing.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, the system and a lot of the stuff that we do with the national team, it's just a more detailed version of what I just said right there. And you guys know, you know, John, you're coaching with Tom Black at LMU, and he put it in a really clear way that I like. It kind of crystallized what I was already trying to do was you make two columns, and one column is the things that are important for the game, like what's most important in the game and also relative to your level, because it could be, you know, maybe blocking is really important in men's college volleyball. Maybe it's not as important 14 under. But the one column is what are the most important things in order of importance in the game? And then the other column is what is my team best at? And hopefully those two columns look similar. And where I just look for the discrepancy, if there's something that's pretty important to be able to do in the game, to be able to be more successful and to win more matches, and my team is not good at it, well, wherever the biggest difference in between those two columns, that's what I got to work on more at practice.
Let's start with the national team level. What does that column look like? If you could give us like the 6 skills, what's the priorities?
Yes. Yeah. Serving, passing is number one. Serving, I guess you would say serving number one, because serving always has to be a little more important than passing because there are some serves that don't go in the court. So there's always a few more serves than there are passes. But serving and passing is right up there. And first ball attacking is probably next. And then setting is probably real near the top. And transition hitting's up there. And then probably blocking is probably a little more important than digging when we get to the national team level. Certainly at the high school level, digging is more important than blocking. But at the national team level, blocking is probably a little more important, and digging is probably at the bottom.
Are there any other changes in that order at the high school level other than blocking and digging?
There's a couple sort of trends as you go from lower level to higher level. So number one is, as you go to a higher level, it seems that setting becomes more important. And blocking also becomes more important. And it kind of makes sense that as blocking becomes more important because blockers are better, then setting becomes more important because part of the job of the setter is to put hitters in situations where they're not facing as good of a block. You know, trap sets become stuff blocks at high levels. And, you know, part of the job of the setter is to isolate a hitter against one blocker and stuff like that. So as you go higher level, blocking obviously becomes a little more important and setting becomes a little more important. Or really, I should say the setter herself or himself becomes a more important position. You know, if you're talking about 12 and under, your individual setter does not have as big of an influence on the game because most of the time you're not even getting the ball to the setter. But when you get to the national team level, be it men or women, you can make a case that your setter's close to or possibly even more valuable than your outside hitters. So as you go up that level, that gets a little more important.
So then once you make that list, whatever level you're at, then are you thinking about it like percentage-wise? Like, okay, I've prioritized serving, so I know I have to do that, whatever, 80% of the practice that has to be going on, or 100% of the practice, and blocking is at the bottom of my list, so I'm only going to do that every other day.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it, and that's probably most of it, the way you just described it, just kind of knowing generally. And then a slight modification to that is you just look at your own strengths and weaknesses. And you might say, hey, blocking is not the most important skill for a high school team, but we are so bad at it. We need to spend some time at it. You know what I mean? Or you might say blocking, yeah, it's not too important and we're already decent at it, so we can spend a little less time here. So it's probably 80%. Just looking at the overall trend and the important factors at your level. And then it's 20%. Okay, let's make some modifications for our individual team. But with that said, I think most teams and players are not quite as unique as they like to think they are. And most of us just benefit a lot from just looking at what makes successful teams successful.
Typically, coaches have statted passing on a 3-point or a 4-point scale. You know, 3 being a perfect pass, they can set 3 hitters. 2, they can set 2 hitters, and so on. What do you think of that sort of metrics for statting passing?
I think it's good. I think it works just fine. A lot of times, I even think something as simple as perfect pass percentage or good and perfect pass, you know, in-system pass percentage.
How do you define in-system?
I think the definition of in-system is if you can set a middle attacker reliably. So I think that's okay. Just a pretty decent rule of thumb. For most teams, high school team or something, in-system pass percentage works just fine. And I actually like that because it's pretty easy for players to understand, and it's pretty easy to set up a practice activity based off that. So a lot of times to a kid, 2.2, 2.3, 2.4 doesn't mean a whole lot, but 40, 50, 60% is pretty relatable. You know, you might have high school passers passing a lot of times somewhere between those. And then also, it's very conducive to making a practice activity where you say, all right, we got 9 serves and we got to pass 5 of them in system or something like that. So I like all these things to be well connected to what the practice activity is going to be, especially at the lower level. You know, at the national team, we have to make some finer decisions because we have a large pool of athletes. So we have more of a selection that we have to make. But for most coaches, you know, you pick your team at tryouts, and then throughout the year, your team is your team. You know, you might need to know a little bit about who your best passer is, but if you can have something and you're talking in a language that your players can understand, and it translates well to designing practice activities, I really like that. However you do it, just make sure it's going to translate to practice.
Have you ever had anything that statistically works really well in a practice that maybe doesn't translate into games?
So I like to, you know, like a lot of coaches, I think the more you compete, it always makes practice fun. And just recording a lot of information, you see a lot of things. And I think sometimes the scores or the players in something like a 3-on-3 activity, sometimes that translates well to who your best players are in a match. And then you always see some weird aberrations where there's a player who just is no good at 3-on-3, but they manage to be pretty effective in 6-on-6. So I think that's something where you don't want to get caught too much into statting everything at practice and then missing some opportunities where players can still help your team in 6-on-6. And I would say that's a situation where if you're sort of statting all these 3-on-3 sort of games and scoring all of those, it's probably going to be good 5 out of 6 times. But you might have that 6th player who maybe has a more specialized role when you get to 6-on-6. It could be a middle blocker who doesn't do much else well than hit a slide. But that's pretty valuable if you figure out a way to use them. And they might be no good in 3-on-3, but they might be pretty good in 6-on-6.
Cool. And when you're talking about keeping stats of practice, is everything important to stat? Or are there times in practice where learning takes priority? Or even on those times where they're learning a skill, there's stuff we should be measuring?
I think for sure you have some times that where you're not statting anything and you're trying to make some changes. Yeah, absolutely. This is something that we're pretty interested in the national team, because the way our season is structured is we might have a few weeks of practice with no competition against another team, and then we have a whole bunch of competition right in a row. So we would love to have more information about what stats translate really well from practice that predict match performance. And something that we found is hitting and blocking statistics, there's only actually not that high of a correlation into match statistics, but serving and passing translated really well. This is at least what we've seen over the past 3 years and correlating some data. Pretty much the best servers and passers in practice tend to be your best servers and passers in a match. They don't always translate one-to-one in terms of, you know, if I'm passing 50% in system in practice, it's not always 50% in a match, but it's pretty much your order is pretty similar. But for us, at least, we saw a pretty limited correlation between how they attacked and blocked in practice and how they attacked and blocked in matches. So that's the fact. But and my opinion of it is, I think there's some hitters that they play around a lot in practice and they try some different shots and they might work on expanding their range. And typically your error rate is significantly higher in practice than it is in the match, because you have setters trying to dial their timing and this and that. And then a lot of times those hitters who are trying to expand their range and go to the shots, when they get in the match, they're just going to the shot that they know is going to score. So that's something that was pretty interesting that we found out, where when we're trying to look at all this practice data and see if it helps inform our match, who's going to make rosters or something like that, we look at the statistics a little less for attacking and blocking than we do serving and passing.
Does that correlate to scrimmage games as well in practice?
Yeah, even that kind of stuff. So we call them, red blues, like exhibition matches. And there was definitely a higher correlation between all the skills in those red blue matches, because we're going out of our practice gym. We're putting a uniform on. We have an outside ref and we have a crowd. So those statistics had the most transfer from anything that we did in practice, because they're a competition of themselves.
Do the numbers ever bear out such a thing as a gamer, like someone who in practice is so-so and then in competition they explode statistically?
I don't think we've had anybody that has had that over the long term, but there has been several times where we've had players where their practice performance has not been great statistically leading into a competition, and they performed really well in competition. And when we had those situations, and then hindsight's always 20/20, but we kind of looked at it, it wasn't because that player was dogging it in practice. They were underperforming statistically because they were trying to make a change. So they weren't super effective in practice, but they were making changes. And then they kind of made the changes right at the right time leading into competition, and they performed really well in competition. So certainly I think that happens. There's no player that's been like that over 3 years where they've consistently been terrible in practice and did the match.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because, I mean, we always, at least here, we talk about, you know, the learning zone. You have to be making mistakes and being at the edge of your abilities. So anybody who's doing that obviously is not going to have the numbers they want in practice.
Yeah. You know what? We don't use the practice statistics too much to inform our roster selections and our starting lineups. We use them some, but for us, by far the most important thing that we take into that consideration is your performance in competition. That's probably 80% of the statistics we use is competition statistics. And like we said, that's why we really like having these exhibition matches, because for us, we could go 4-5 weeks without a competition. So that's why we really like having these exhibition matches. We usually play them on Fridays. So we have the week of practice, and then we might play this red-blue match on Friday night. And that allows us to have this learning zone throughout the week of practice. And then Friday night, we still have the competition. So as coaches, we give them that learning zone, but then we also get the evaluative zone at the end of the practice week. And just for us and our schedule, that happens to work out really well. Whereas if you're a high school or college team and you're just playing two matches a week, then it works out perfectly. Practice is your time for your learning zone, and your competition, that's your evaluation period as a coach.
So then why is that practice at all? And then on top of that, do you communicate that to your players? Or are they, I could see if they know you're statting practice, like, oh, I'm nervous about making mistakes. I don't want to be pushing myself.
Yeah, so all that's really important stuff. So first of all, why stat practice? Well, just in terms of how it actually happens for us, you know, we use Data Volley, and why we end up statting practice is because that's also the same tool for us that syncs it to video and chops it all up in all these video clips. So we really only look at our practice statistics at the end of the week. We're generally not looking at day to day. Oh, this person had 6 kills on 9 swings today, and yesterday they had 3 on 7 swings. We just kind of look at the end of the week. And like I said, it's not the main evaluation criteria, but we always have that information. We always end up statting it because it's what syncs with the video for us. And that's crucial for us. We're reviewing the video every day for sure. But like you said, I think the reason to stat in practice is to try to show improvement. So that's the main stuff that we want to talk to them about. So if we're asking them, for example, to change a blocking move, maybe say this player, they had this static blocking move against the slide, and we want to teach them to be more dynamic. Well, we might come to them and say, hey, look, slide hitters are hitting 400 against you right now with this static move, and we want you to change and make this dynamic move. And you know what? They might have a practice or two where their performance decreases, but hopefully their performance will start increasing. Otherwise, we're coaching it wrong. So if we're coaching it right and they're doing it right, their performance should start to improve. And if we can start showing them, hey, at the end of this week, even though it's a new skill and you're still not 100% at it, hey, hitters went from hitting 400 against you to hitting 380. And let's keep getting better at this. So I think the main reason to stat practice, most important one, is to be able to show improvement and find an area where your kids or your team can get fired up about making improvement and want to make more improvement. And then the number two reason would be if you have to go a long period of time. It could be a club team. Maybe you have 3 weeks between a tournament and you're really not sure about who's going to be the starter. You might need to use some practice statistics to help you form your lineup if that's all you have. And then if there's a third reason, maybe it might help raise a competition level. Just like you said, there might be some anxiety about, oh, I know I'm getting evaluated. And that might help create a little bit more of a stressful practice environment, which is not what we want all the time, but it might be what we want some of the time if the level is not competitive enough in practice and they need a little something. But that's probably, I would say, the least important aspect.
Yeah, I know that's one of the arguments for the Cauldron Someone like Anson Dorrance at North Carolina, he stats everything, but it doesn't inform who plays in the matches. It's just all about getting them to care about every rep, like to practice as hard as they can. I think it's just, again, about communicating to your players how you're going to use these numbers and what they mean to you.
I think that there's some real pros to it, and I think that there's some definite cons to it. One example of a situation where I thought it was really effective was actually with, you know, like a 14 and under group. We had 8 players on the team. You know, we did some normal practice activities that weren't being scored. You know, just you're learning. And then we did a bunch of small group games. And kind of how we did it was everybody's going to get to play. But the top 4 Cauldron people for the week, they're going to get to play all the way around. And then the bottom 4, game 1, you're going to play back row. And game 2, you'll play front row. So everybody still plays front row and back row. But the top 4 in the Cauldron, they get to play all the way around. Bottom 4, they got to play half the time. And how it ended out, because it was a pretty balanced team, every single player had times where they were in the top 4. And every player had some times where they were in the bottom 4. So I felt it made for competitive practice. And I also felt it helped teach them a little accountability. For that team, it fit well. It actually really made things fun. And I think one of the main reasons to use a competitive cauldron type thing or just some sort of competition in practice, which is going to lead to me playing a game, is it should be fun. If it's stressing people out so much that it's making practice totally unenjoyable, then it's probably not appropriate. But I bet everybody, you know, certainly all 4 of us, and I guarantee anybody listening, has played things like, you know, winner stays on or loser buys dinner or whatever it is. And that's the fun part of competition. So setting things up like that, where it's not this life or death, the cauldron is telling you your self-worth, but it's like, hey, we're going to play a game and we're going to get after it. And we're going to put a little something on the line here and it should make things more fun. And it's not going to be the case where that's going to do that every time. So it's not appropriate every time, because it's not appropriate when I already know who's going to win the cauldron before we even do the drills. I got to have a fair shot to win.
Yeah, that happens with us. Like John and I bet lunch and there's really no point. He's going to have to pay for my lunch anyways.
Yeah, right. I don't remember that ever.
That was an example of it working well. You said you had another one where maybe statting practice.
Yeah, so just an example where it didn't work well and I threw it out halfway through the year was I was coaching a 17s club team. We're doing some cauldron for that. And, you know, I just had 2 outside hitters that, you know, they could play 80% in practice and they were still going to be able to win the cauldron and be the starters. And one of the players still went pretty hard and she was doing the right thing. And then the other player, she did just enough to be number 2. So she was still in the starting lineup. And, you know, maybe you guys, you got the book club going a little bit. And I really love the book Drive by Daniel Pink. And he talks about motivation 2.0. And he talks about situations where external rewards can actually demotivate by changing the emphasis or whatever you focus on. And we've all probably experienced this, something like that. You know, like if you love to draw and you'll draw all day for free, just for your free time because you love it. But then somebody comes and says, hey, I'll give you $1 for every drawing. You might end up making less drawings because now it's shifting. Well, you don't really care about that dollar. That doesn't matter too much to me. So it kind of almost, in this case, with some of these a couple of those players on that particular team, it shifted their focus away from the joy of playing hard and winning in practice to, okay, what do I need to do to stay in the starting lineup in the cauldron? And then that almost put a ceiling on their effort level. And then the player that kept getting out of the starting lineup, she just wasn't good enough yet. And it was demotivating for her because she's busting her butt in practice, but she just can't quite beat out this player. And, you know, it was demotivating for all parties involved. And I had to throw it out. So it's kind of weird how one year it can work really well and the other year it can work terribly. And it was just based on the players on the team. And I think it's just a tool.
Awesome.
Joe, just a broader question. when thinking about how the data shapes our strategies, is there any like volleyball traditions that you see or assume happen in most like high school gyms that doesn't really align with what science says?
Yeah. So I had the good fortune to be able to be Mark Dunphy's assistant coach with the Pepperdine Men. And he talks about you have to coach in reality. And that always stuck with me. I read that in, I think it was like the USA Volleyball Impact Manual like 10 years ago. And that kind of stuck with me. And then I got to see firsthand how he applied it. And so just broadly, I think a lot of those things that happen in high school gyms is coaching for what should happen rather than what actually does happen. So here's an example is there's a few sort of mythical beings out there. You know, there's the Yeti and there's a Loch Ness monster that a lot of people claim to have seen. And then there's the shadow of the block. And I hear a lot about the shadow of the block, but yet I still see a lot of balls just getting hit right there. So I'm still searching for that mythical beast that a lot of coaches seem to want to have. And certainly at the high school level for girls volleyball, the block just doesn't funnel anything. And even going up to the national team level, I have this sort of depository of video clips of well-formed double blocks or seemingly well-formed double blocks, and the ball just seems to end up going right through them or over them or splitting hands or field going or what have you or under them. And I think that's one thing where a lot of high school coaches, certainly they have this notion that they're going to perfectly coordinate the block with the back row defenders. And then there's a lot of the ball lands and the blocker is getting scolded for not having blocked that ball. And I just think if you just put your defender there, you wouldn't have to worry about anything else. So that's an example of coaching for what should happen rather than what does happen.
I love that. I feel like I've had to fight that a lot in my coaching. You know, the defender says, oh, there was a hole there. That's why I went there. So, well, were you looking at the hitter's shoulder? They were facing angle, and there's no reason to fill a hole when the hitter's telling you something completely different. So it's like, why are we basing our defense on something that's not there based on what we can actually see and react to? So, yeah, that's a frustrating one. I like that one.
And then what happens is then the defender is looking at the block rather than the hitter. So it's kind of a double whammy.
I had an experience with that as well, where I had both of my blockers and my defenders basically in the player's tendency that they were hitting, you know, 80-90% of the time. And both my defenders and my blockers couldn't understand why we were both standing in the same spot or blocking the same thing or defending against the same thing. It was like, cause she hits it 80% of the time. And it doesn't matter if you have both there too. And it was a long conversation afterward to try to explain them. I wish I had that coach in reality or play in reality.
Yeah. And you know what, like the way I think about it is, you know, I'm an NBA fan and I've been out of touch being in Germany recently, but now I'm getting back into it a little bit. And it's like you watch James Harden play and everybody knows he's going left and the scouting report says, don't let this guy go left and all this. And then he gets in the game and he still scores 20 points a game going to his left. And it's like if a hitter has a good cross court shot, they will get the ball cross court. And you can put your blockers wherever you want it to happen. And if they're a good hitter, they're going to get the ball cross court. So, yeah, exactly like you said, Niels, block cross court, but then understand they're still going to get it over there sometimes. So you still better be ready to dig it.
Can you speak about digging in the middle of the court? You know, that's been kind of one of the trends is having somebody standing in the exact middle because that's where a lot of balls go.
Yeah, middles is that's what we call it. We're talking about halfway between the attack line and the end line. There's an awful lot of balls that go there. And it's pretty funny, you know, Carl McGowan is a great coach and a guy who's done a lot for volleyball in this country. And my first interaction with him was telling him that he was a fool for this middle idea because I was pretty convinced that it wasn't the case. And then, you know, he replied to me like he does to a lot of people with make your own damn chart then. And I did. I think unlike a lot of people, I did. And I got about four matches in before I realized he was on to something. So this is one of those things where, you know, you have like the coaching reality should happen versus what does happen. And then the other thing is coaching to the mean, meaning our brain is really good at picking up outliers and our brain is not good at picking up averages. So when we watch 20 attacks, we'll just notice the five different type of attacks that happen, but we're not good at picking up the frequency at which they happen. So if there's 20 balls and there was a deep line shot and there was a seam ball hit right to zone six and there was a tip and there was a sharp cross, we'll just note that those four balls attacked. But we won't note that the deep line only happened twice, the sharp cross only happened twice, and the ball hit right to zone six happened 12 times. So we're really good at picking up the total number of different things that happen, but we're not good at picking up the frequency or the averages. So, I mean, it's just a fact that in volleyball, in all levels, up to about really international level women is where you start to see a little bit of deviance from this. But you go all the way up to that level, and there's just so many balls that get hit right in the dead middle of the court. And there's not a ton of painting the line. There's not a ton of sharp cross if you just look at the overall population. And then, of course, you know, that doesn't mean that every hitter hits every ball there. You know, you have some hitters who they'll hit a lot of cross, or some hitters that hit a lot of line, or some hitters that tip a lot. But, you know, certainly high school volleyball and certainly college women's volleyball, probably 50% of the balls are going within a 5-foot radius of right smack in the middle of zone six.
Yeah, I know you've written a couple good blogs on the Gold Medal Squared site, kind of detailing your heat maps and going through that. So I recommend anybody, any coach, to go check that out. Joe goes into a lot more detail. I was curious, Billy and I and Nils has played beach, and we have a kind of a beach perspective as well. And I don't know how much background you have with it, but do you have any idea about how we should be playing defense on the beach? Any thoughts on if our traditional model of a line blocker and an angle defender is correct? Or I don't know, maybe we're doing it all wrong.
I have no idea actually about that, but it's something that I'd really love to study. And I'm actually hoping to, with all the ton of spare time that I have, but I'm hoping to actually do that a little bit more, because I think it's pretty interesting. I think there's something to really be gained by looking at, you know, these little chunks of the game and beach volleyball only being 2-on-2. I think there's some real things that we could learn. And that's actually something that I want to study a little bit more. But for right now, I got nothing for you. Hopefully it's something we're going to learn as we go.
Let us know when you do learn, because I bet we're doing it all wrong. And your heat maps will teach us something very new and interesting. You don't tell anybody but us.
Yeah, it can be a private email.
You know what, though? Bill James, who he's kind of the godfather of baseball statistics. He's really, really bright guy who looks at things pretty different way. He likes to say a good statistic will tell you 80-90% of what you already knew, and then it'll help you pick up the 10 or 20% that you didn't notice or that were a little contrary. So I bet when we study it, most of what we find is just going to be common sense, and then there's going to just be these couple of other cases or these couple other things. All right, okay, we didn't know that. That slipped under our radar. Or what you get is, oh, I kind of knew that, but I didn't realize how important it was. A side tangent with that is when we looked at setting in the indoor game, I think everybody knows that setting the ball tight is bad, or setting the ball a little too far wide, you know, a little past the antenna is bad. But when we studied it, we didn't realize how bad it was. It was something like, wow, like the magnitude. So sometimes that's where some statistic research or some data can help you point out, okay, I knew this wasn't good, but holy crap, I didn't realize it was that bad, so this can never happen again, kind of thing.
So that was part one of our talk with Joe Trunzi. Tune in next week to hear part two.
They've done studies, you know, 60% of the time, it works every time.
Hi, and welcome to Coach Your Brains Out. This is part two of our conversation with Joe Trunzi.
Are there any other things, like, so you reference outside the antenna or tight to the net, that's pretty common. Is there anything that you've found that maybe most people don't know about that's really statistically don't do that?
Well, the number one thing by far, I was going to say at the high school level, but maybe even at the collegiate level, is pass off the net, dig off the net, set off the net, and set the ball inside. And it's just the efficiencies really drop off quickly. Certainly in high school volleyball, when passes or digs get tight and low. And then, of course, we have this idea around the variance around any target is equally distributed. And if I aim 1 foot off the net, I will overpass some of those balls. And if I aim 5 feet off the net, I'll overpass less. If I play darts, I'm going to miss an equal amount low and high over the course of whatever, you know, wherever my median point is, my errors will be equally distributed around it. So just passing off the net. And then the same thing, a tight set is more than twice as bad of a mistake as setting the ball too far off. You know, so it's twice as bad to set the ball a foot and a half off the net as it is to set the ball 7-8 feet off the net. 7-8 feet off the net is not a good set, but it's a better mistake than setting the ball a foot and a half off the net. So, and if I understand that my errors are equally distributed, then maybe I can't aim 3 feet off the net, even though 3 feet off the net would be a great set. Maybe I have to aim 4 feet off the net. Maybe if I'm not a very good setter, I might even have to aim 5 feet off the net. So just understanding that concept is huge. And then also the idea of passing and digging off the net, especially digging off the net. This kind of goes back to what should happen versus what does happen. And just in high school volleyball, it is just a rampant thing where you will see a quote-unquote perfect dig that's dug 3 feet off the net, and the setter winds up barely even touching the ball. Best case scenario, they just have to push it over the net. But a lot of times they wind up making a setting error because high school setters just, they don't see the game as fast and they don't transition as quickly. And all of a sudden this perfect dig, when the setter is having to release from the backcourt, they barely even touch the ball. So that's one thing where just doing camps or having an opportunity to go around and work with a lot of different teams in a short period of time, I've seen a bunch of, I can think of probably a half dozen examples where just in the course of like a 2 hour clinic, their team's ability to hit and transition probably improved by 5% just by emphasizing digging the ball off the net. So that's probably most high school volleyball coaches, most high school girls or boys coaches could probably improve their transition efficiency by 5% just by getting crazy about digging the ball off the net. And 3 feet is too tight when you're talking about digging the ball in transition.
Joe, I've heard the research that says passing midline's great, passing left side's good, passing right side, never. Can you talk about where that study came from, who was looked at, and then why that is?
Yeah, this is something that's just been studied a ton. And I think Carl McGowan started studying this in the 80s or 90s, and we just keep redoing the study every few years and getting a pretty similar result that shows that when we pass the ball in our midline, which I'll say is kind of like between our knees, for lack of a better term. Yeah, we pass really well. And when we pass the ball on the left side of our body, we tend to pass the ball still pretty well. And when we pass the ball on the right side of our body, not too well. But what I'll say to that is every passer still has to pass the ball on the right side of their body sometime. You know, specifically talking about the indoor game here, I don't know if those statistics translate to the beach game as much. I would imagine they don't. But you're still going to have to pass the ball on the right side of your body probably 20% of the time. Even if you're building a system to try to avoid that, you're still going to have to pass the ball on the right sometimes. So I don't think that we can ever totally eliminate that. And the better the server that we play, the more they're going to serve to these tough spots. So I think we set up our tactic. We're trying to pass much more balls on our left than we are on our right. But when we do our training, we got to spend at least as much time passing the ball on the right than we do on the left, because it's hard.
And that doesn't matter if you're left-handed, right-handed. It's just all across the board.
You know, I don't know if it matters if you're left-handed or right-handed. I've actually never looked at that or even thought about it until you just said it.
Is there any guess as to why that is?
Whenever I talk to people about this, I kind of say the result is fact. And then I'll offer some opinions about why the result occurs. But whenever I tell this to people, I always say, my opinion might suck, but don't let my crappy opinion negate the fact that the result is certainly fact. My opinion is it's just the geometry of the game, because it turns out that the zone one passer passing on the right is not too bad. It kind of follows from there that I think it's, so again, this opinion is, if I'm in zone five and I pass the ball on my left, I kind of make an acute angle if I'm getting my trigonometry terms right, where my angle is kind of closed towards the net and I'm contacting the ball kind of in front of this sort of 90 degree, if my body is parallel to the net and then there's a, you know, a line there. So my angle is kind of out front, for lack of a better term, even if I'm turned to this, you know, I might turn to the side so that you're relative to the net's not in front, but my angle is kind of out there. Whereas if I'm a zone five passer and I pass the ball on my right, I have to get the ball to still go to my right over to the target. So then my angle has got to kind of be open. So I think that if the passing target was zone four, it would be better to pass on your right. That makes, so that's my opinion about how to rebound it. And actually there's this kind of older book. I don't know. It was written in like maybe 90 or might even be in the 80s by Ari Selinger. And, you know, I'd never met Ari Selinger, but I really like his book. And he kind of almost approaches it from an engineering perspective and talks about kind of incidence angles and angles of reflection. So I think you have to be a lot more precise. For example, if you're the zone five passer passing on your right, because if you open your angle slightly too much, the ball's going to shank behind you. And if you close your angle too much, you're going to pass the ball straight ahead into zone four, which is a tough ball for the setter to get to. Whereas when you're in zone five passing on your left, if you close your angle off a little too much, you still put it over into zone two and it's still a pretty good pass. And if you open your angle a little bit, you're still kind of in 3-4, you know, it's still a decent pass. So that's my opinion on why it happens.
Interesting. So yeah, it doesn't sound like it would translate to the beach, but I guess we wouldn't know until we did the numbers.
Yeah, my guess on the beach is the left side partner is going to pass more efficiently on his left and the right side partner is going to pass more efficiently on his right. But but I don't 100% know that to be true.
Yeah, we need you on the beach. I have a question about serving. It's kind of broad. What percent should we be serving in? And I guess that probably depends on the level. And should we prioritize speed or movement or location?
People more educated in the motor learning than me tell us that anything that requires speed and accuracy simultaneously, they both have to be trained simultaneously. And there's a low transfer if we just work on one at a time. What that means is we have to serve hard and accurate at the same time. So if I'm coaching a young server, I can't just say, hey, try to serve every ball in and then we'll slowly work on serving it harder. And I also can't say hit as absolutely hard as you can and then we'll start trying to get the ball in the court. We should just work on serving with an efficient mechanic. And over time, I should be hitting it harder and in more often. So kind of how that relates to your question is, I think there is some trade-off between power and accuracy, a slight amount, if hitters are serving it really hard, float servers. But most of the best float servers in women's international volleyball are getting close to 95% of their serves in. And there's a few aberrations who are hitting really aggressive jump floaters that are maybe only making 88 to 90% of their serves. There's a few of them, you know, one of them being Kim Hill on the national team. She's a slightly higher error server who's still top five, top 10 in the world server.
Is that based on? Why is she that?
So the statistic that we really like for evaluating servers and passers is this statistic that we call expected side out. So it's kind of just a 4-point passing scale on steroids. It's almost like a 100-point passing scale. So we know the expected side out rate on a perfect pass, on a good pass, on a medium pass, like, you know, we have 6 grades of pass that we use. So we know, generally speaking, what a top 5 international women's team will side out on those quality of passes. So then instead of saying, okay, 4 times perfect plus 3 times good plus 2 times medium, you know, on that sort of passing scale, basically what we say is, okay, then it's like 78 times perfect plus 72 times good. Yeah, you know, so it's just changing. It's the same idea. We just changed the coefficient. And actually, we actually use the first ball side out number. There's a reason for that I'll get to in a second. But basically, it's just a little bit more accurate is the first one. So that's how we really evaluate the servers and the passers. Because for passers, like I said, helps us get a little more accurate. And then for servers, we can't just use point scoring percentage because A, servers on good teams will be overrated because their block will block balls even when the opponent passed perfectly. And then B, you know, it'll underrate good servers on bad teams who can't block or dig any balls. So we can't just use point scoring. So it's almost this expected point scoring, imagining I had an average block and an average defender and all that. And then the other reason that we really like it and the reason why we use its expected first ball side out, because it gives us actually this really great comparison as the match is going on, but also after the match where we say, okay, our expected first ball side out based on our quality of pass was 40. And we actually first ball sided out at 43. So that means our offense did about as well as we could hope for. And in order to first ball side out better, we'd have to pass better. Or it could be the vice versa where we expect we pass at an expected first ball side out of 40, but we only first ball sided out at 37. And then in that case, we'd say, hey, you know what? We passed well enough to side out to win, but our offense and setter didn't come through. So it just gives us this really easy comparison and puts it directly on the same terms.
Really easy.
Yeah, exactly. If we need to side out 1% better, we know how much better we need to pass.
It's a lot of stuff to consider.
Wow.
You know, that takes advantage of the fact that we have some resources and tools with the national team that probably not every high school coach has. Certainly, probably no high school coach has.
Nils does.
So yeah, except Nils.
I have two iPads.
I was wondering if you were going to dive into the beach game, what metrics would you prioritize? What would be the first study you'd look at?
You know what? I think one of the first things that I would look at is basically attack efficiency based on distance from the setter. You know, I'm a pretty novice beach player, but it certainly seems like there's some things to be worked out there where, you know, you pass and you come and you hit close to the setter, but say I'm on the left and I pass it to, you know, the indoor zone two, you know, how much should I follow my pass and get closer to the setter versus how much should I go to a essentially fixed versus a floating setting target? And of course, I mean, that might relate to your conditions as well. I mean, obviously on a windy day, you can't set it as far. So I think that's one of the first things that I'd look at is just trying to figure out some efficiency based on distance from the setter. And then there's always going to be individual scouting and matchups, but I'd be interested in classifying a whole range of shot options and just seeing if there's any that are underused or overused. Like, for example, indoor players probably tip too much and they probably don't hit the block enough. You know, indoor hitters, if you just look at only their balls that they hit into the block, there's a lot of hitters who hit for a high percentage. And actually, we looked at that at USA. And at one point in the 2014 season, not looking at any ball that was hit past the block, so only balls that the block touched. So that includes balls that we tooled and balls that we stuffed and balls that were soft blocked and so on and so forth. We were hitting like 390. And we were like, man, we just should hit every ball in the block and we would never lose. So, but I mean, of course, that's not the case. But just what it means is our hitters were basically too passive. They were overutilizing roll shots and tips and underutilizing, you know, wipes off the block or tools or hit it into the block and get it back and so on and so forth. So I'd be curious to know if there are any shots that beach players overuse just as a general trend and any that they underuse.
Nice. Yeah, love to learn that stuff. Another kind of random question. Is there a way to use data on the recruiting side? And do you think there are things in volleyball that we've been overvaluing, especially early in the selection process, that's created a certain kind of athlete? Things like height, arm speed. Obviously, socioeconomics is a big thing in our sport.
I don't have too many guesses on that. But when I was at LMU, the recruiting coordinator was a guy named John Newman Gontar. He kind of had this idea that I think is really fascinating about the composition of teams based on kind of the geographic or the demographic that the team is drawing from. Kind of this idea that I don't know if a successful team has 14 players from 14 different states and 14 different backgrounds and 14 different ways they grew up and way they talk and communicate. And I'd be curious to know and this would be a tough study. I don't even know how I would do it, but just something about, is there a tipping point where maybe you have 12 people who come from a common background or they work really well together, and then you bring in two players from outside. You've got to bring in two players from outside and they still manage to work well together. And is there a tipping point where you have too many different people, too many different players, and it hinders your ability to work together as a team, or does that not matter at all? So I'd be actually curious to dive into the demographics of recruiting and how that relates, because just I certainly see it. There's a lot of colleges, they have a desire to really expand their recruiting net, and you know, you have allocation of resources, and should they be trying to cast the widest net possible, or should they be taking this sort of mindset where, hey, we're going to go more local and we're going to go really deep in one area? And I have no idea which one is better or if one is better than the other, but I'd like to study that if I could.
Coming from the national team, have you noticed any patterns as far as diversification there or non-diversification of like region or anything like that?
You know what? Not too much. What you actually see a lot more is they clump together by age. It's usually the vets hang out with the vets and the rookies hang out with the rookies. You know, generally for us, it's not, hey, get the California kids and the Midwestern kids to mix, or get the black players and the white players to mix. It's usually we got to get the rookies and the vets to mix a little bit more. But that in and of itself is a question saying, with the balance of a team, the veteran mix versus the rookie mix, and is there some sort of optimal mix where we have enough veteran experience and also enough sort of youthful vigor, or whatever, however you want to describe it. And I think some of this stuff is already maybe being looked at, you know, because I'm sure in the business world, they're already looking at stuff like this, because, you know, wherever there's more money is where the data is going to be researched the quickest. But I think it'd be really interesting to look at, you know, how quantitative data can help us better understand seemingly subjective things such as composition of teams or teamwork or something like that, that seems very mystical. You know, I think that the people that are really knowledgeable in those aspects, they understand the behavior, leadership, and teamwork is probably not so mystical as people like me, who maybe don't understand it as well, seem to think. You know, when I talk to these really knowledgeable sports psychologists like Mike Gervais or Andrea Becker, they're not talking, you know, mumbo jumbo. They're just talking about pretty concrete actions. And if we have concrete actions that we know lead to people being more effective teammates and more effective leaders, it sure seems like we could study them a little bit and say just how valuable are these actions or those actions, how deleterious are these actions or these other actions.
When it comes to strategy, does more people listening to the data affect the data? For instance, if everybody gets on board of free ball into zone two or jump floating, and all of a sudden we're seeing it a lot more and practicing it more, does it change how effective it is? Like, do we need to stay ahead of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I think it certainly does, without question. And I think it affects it more in strategic areas than, for lack of a better term, technical areas. You know, I think that there are certain things just either biomechanically or physically that are going to be more effective. So all things being equal, a jump float's going to be more effective than a standing float. It's just the biomechanics of it are better. But I agree with you. If every team is only sending free balls to zone two, then the team that starts shooting a couple of the deep five is probably going to see some success. And those sort of game theory things, I certainly think staying ahead of those is important. It's kind of like playing poker. If you're at a table with a bunch of loose guys who are just getting in every hand, you make money by just sitting on really good cards and then getting them paid off. But on the other hand, if you're sitting around with a bunch of tightwads, you make money by being really aggressive. So that's just kind of basic game theory. And I certainly think that applies to areas like, you know, specific offense and block defense factor.
I was curious about if you had any statistical information to defend the idea of a hot hand. If that's a human creation, or if there is something behind that, that people catch fire and we need to set them a time.
You know, it's hard to prove a negative, but I haven't seen anybody really be able to prove that it exists. So I don't put too much stock in a hot hand. A lot of times the hot hand is going to be your better player. So I put a lot more stock in that.
And then just thinking about some elementary mistakes maybe people make when tracking data, like something like sample size. And I know I've done that a lot where, like, oh, I got to figure out who's going to be my libero. I'll stat practice, you know, 3 days in a row, and then I'll figure it out. What is a good sample size?
So some rules of thumb are competition data is the best predictor of future competition data. So if I have a choice between 100 passes from real matches a month ago and 100 passes from practice today, I'm going to use the competition matches from a month ago. That's in the case of certainly national team and probably collegiate, but maybe high school, I would go with the more recent data because players are still evolving so much. An absolutely small sample size or unrepresentative sample size, those are the two big directions. If anybody here has a strong statistical background, I'm sure this will get picked apart. But in the interest of just trying to help practical people who aren't interested in a math class, I would say try to have close to 100 and certainly more than 50 in your sample size. And I think you'll get something meaningful from that. You know, it's not going to be the end all be all, and more is always better. But maybe if you have at least 50 passes before you start making the decisions, you have some level of information. But with that said, your sample size has to be representative. You know, if I play against the weakest team in conference and you play against the better team, of course I'm going to look better. The danger where that comes into is the sort of starters versus subs. And a lot of times your subs will put up these great numbers because they're only playing in mop-up time. And your starters have to battle, you know, through these really tough matches. So making sure whatever you look at is representative is really crucial.
That's good advice.
I don't know if it's out there, but it's one thing that I've thought about a lot. What about a statistic that tracks players' performance like after 20 or after 22 or in that critical time at the end of a match, especially when it's close, and looking for statistical abnormalities or better performance or worse performances in that situation?
So the tough thing about that is we have the most information on stuff like that with professional players. And it seems like by the time people get to be professional players, they're all really good in the clutch. So in professional sports, it seems like clutch does exist. It does not seem like it's repeatable from year to year. So it seems like one playoff, a guy will be really clutch. It doesn't seem to predict to the next year. With that said, I am certain that in high school volleyball, there are players who fold under pressure and players who don't, and probably the same in college. But we don't have databases of statistics for high school players. So that's kind of that thing is, again, it's representative sample is, I don't think that the clutch exists too much at the professional level because every single one of those players is there because they rocked it in the clutch when they were in high school and in college and stuff like that. And they were the players who dominate every time. And then if you just look at it, it just doesn't seem to be predictive of future clutch performance. Certainly not nearly as much as just your overall level of performance. You know, somebody like David Ortiz, who was this great clutch player, he hit like about the same in the clutch as he did in the regular season because he was just awesome and so on and so forth. I'm not positive, but I would bet absolutely that happens in high school. But I just don't have the data on it to really prove it one way or the other or prove how much the magnitude of the effect is. This is, I'm about to make a pure opinion here, but maybe you guys tell me what you've seen. I kind of feel like at the lower levels, players who are more physical tend to come through in the clutch. And my opinion is based on, you know, as adrenaline gets going, players who are really physical, they can kind of kick it into the next gear. And I feel like I've seen a lot of high school games where it'll get really close and it's the fifth game, 10-10. And all of a sudden, you know, whichever team has that really physical player, they just set them 50 balls at the net. And that player just goes up and dunks on the other team. So that's pure opinion. It's probably biased by a million different things. And it's a horribly unscientific way for me to end this. But maybe the lesson is, as much as we study things, there's always going to be these little opinions that we feel like are true, but we have no way, really way to prove it.
Well, it's good to hear that you're human too. So we're happy that you're among us.
Definitely edit that out.
I don't think we want anybody to be a complete slave to the
Don't tell Karch. So can you give us a little rundown of what's next for you? I know you guys are looking to qualify, and then also what's next for the Volleycast?
Yeah, with Team USA, we're off for a little bit because the players are wrapping up this portion of their kind of the first half of their pro seasons. And then we're meeting up with December 26th in Anaheim to start training. And then we get out January 8th, 9th, 10th. We're going to be in Omaha, Nebraska, I think in front of a lot of fans to play Canada, Puerto Rico, and Dominican Republic. And we're going to try our best to get 3 wins there and qualify for the Rio Olympics. That's certainly 100% more important than the Volleycast. But some opportunity. Actually, I talked to Marv Dunphy, Russ Rose, Tom Black, Dan Fisher, Heather Olmstead, and I kind of got a little bit of a different format for my next podcast. So instead of just one guest for the whole time, I talked to each of them for about 10 minutes, and I'm going to try to edit that together and talk about what a championship run is like, what it's like to get over the hump, what it's like when you're building towards it, and what it's like when you come up a little short and then you're going back for the next year. And those guys had some pretty cool things to say and some pretty interesting similarities between them. So, yeah, in the next 2 weeks, that'll be out.
Joe, final question. Who hits a better down ball, you or Brad Keenan?
You know what? Brad Keenan hits a better down ball than I hit with a full jump. So... we don't even need to go there.
Well, thanks a lot for so much of your time. There's so much good info there. I learned a ton, and I hope all our listeners enjoyed it. And good luck in Rio. We're looking forward to cheering you guys on.
Thanks for coming on, Joe.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. Take care, guys.